The final edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
Welcome to the final edition Radio Hour. I'm Jeff Chrysler, and I'm fake Tony Hendra. Luckily for all of you loyal listeners, I can't do accents for a lick. Everything I do sounds like a mix of South Africa, Australia, Great Britain, and pirate. Right. So I'll skip this fake Tony Hendra. Good move, mate. Because that you're not even starting close. Could you at least start British? No, I can't do that. The real Tony Hendra is on a satire expedition deep in the bowels of America, but he will be back. I'll be back. That's not even a good... Don't worry, everyone. There's plenty of Satirious Hendra appearing in tonight's episode of the final edition Radio Hour, even if he's not here in this open. In fact, the second half of our show features his story about how rock and roll saved his life. But in case you're worried we're getting soft, and we are around the middle, but just not satirically, the rest of the show takes plenty of satirical bites at your mixing metaphors, mate. Shut up. Look, we take bites out of denial, both the GOP and the Pat Sajak kind. We let the South air their TV pilot response to Cosmos, make pop culture tackle real issues, get Woody Allen and Julie Taymor to discuss peak art, visit Pierce Morgan's basement recording studio yet again, provide a Memorial Day tribute to the unknown soldier, and sadly, yet most accurately of all, probably discover what it was like for me to take the SATs and then get into Princeton. It's a sad tale. It is, Tony of Down Under. So sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode of the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Hey, America, I'm Mario Lopez.
And I'm Tracy Edmonds, and this is Extra.
This week, we have the dish on all the craziness of the past week.
Hit me up, Mario. What have you got?
Oh, Tracy, you're not going to believe this. I'm at Ellen, trying to get a dance in with my girl Ellen. And who shows up? Not expecting it, my girl Julia Roberts.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. And I got a dance in with my girl Julia while waiting for my girl Ellen. And Julia clued me in on her new HBO film, The Normal Heart.
Ooh, I heard Mark Ruffalo is in that.
Oh yeah, he and Julia look fabulous together in The Normal Heart on HBO May 25th.
What else you got, Mario?
Oh, the 200 girls in Nigeria are still kidnapped. And now the kidnappers say they're gonna start selling those girls.
Oh, tough news, tough news. Well, speaking of tough news, Cody Simpson and Gigi Hadid have called it quits, as according to their publicists.
Wow, I thought they'd last forever.
Me too. Ugh, and speaking of lasting forever, Vladimir Putin is in Crimea and he ain't leaving.
Right, oh, World War III is right around the corner, and I'm sure the cast of Hawaii Five-0 has a lot to say about that.
They sure do. I caught up with them in Maui, and they all looked fit and fantastic.
Awesome. And there's that glacier that won't stop melting that's going to raise the sea level so significantly.
Whoa, we are all going to drown. I guess I better learn to swim.
Hey, you know who I took a swim with?
Who?
Well, you're going to have to wait until we come back to find out, but here's a hint. He was the star of a few films that had a little something to do with missions that were impossible.
Speaking of missions that are impossible, there's a genocide happening in the world right now.
So exciting! Stick around and we'll get to that and who's wearing who at the People's Choice Awards red carpet.
Can't wait!
Hello. I'm the disgraced and cancelled Piers Morgan, and my guest is the disgraced and rejuvenated Monica Lewinsky. Monica, you wrote a piece for the current Vanity Fair. Are you part of the 90s nostalgia that includes scandals from OJ to Tonya Harding?
No, Piers. I want to own my narrative.
What, do you mean you want to make a Lifetime movie out of it?
No, not a Lifetime movie.
You mean CNN? I think they're already making a Hillary movie. That could be awkward. Try FX.
No, Piers.
Try FXX. They don't have anything on there.
Piers, I'm not interested in making a splash in the media.
And that's why you're making a splash in the media.
Well, you, if anyone, would know how that works, right, Piers?
Yes, but then I'm cancelled. You could drive a petrol truck through the gaps in my understanding.
For 16 years, I've been the girl who gave oral sex to the president, placed his cigars in my ashtray, and stressed the importance of dry cleaning when it comes to blue dresses.
When it comes to blue dresses, or comes on blue dresses?
See, that's what I mean, Piers. I want people to stop talking about me.
But nobody was talking about you until you popped up in Vanity Fair.
I didn't do it for me, Piers. I did it for all the other Monica Lewinsky's out there. If I can be an inspiration to just one, my story will have been worth it.
If your story can inspire just one 24-year-old intern who's having sex with a married president, it will have been worth it.
Piers, please. You know the gay Rutgers student who killed himself because he was filmed kissing another man?
What about him? That was a senseless tragedy.
Piers, part of my new narrative is I'm not above using that senseless tragedy to make a point about what a different Monica I am now.
You mean you're just as willing to exploit a dead gay student you didn't even know as Bill Clinton was to exploit a beret-wearing, non-dress-cleaning intern he did know?
I'm not as powerful as he is, Piers. It took him 8 years to go down in history. It took me 16 years to get into Vanity Fair.
When you say go down in history, do you mean,
Shut up, Piers.
Well, what do you expect from me? I'm yesterday's news, same as you. You don't see me trying to change my narrative. I got lower ratings than the Malaysian plane.
I'm completely different from you, Piers. I'm the new Monica Lewinsky.
All right, what's next for you?
I'll be opening a supermarket with Anthony Weiner and Elliot Spitzer.
This is Piers Morgan for the final edition.
Mr. Pop.
It's time for...
Wheel of Denial!
Our first contestant is Pat Sajak. What do you do, Pat?
I'm a game show host. I'm also a right-wing moron.
Okay. This is a phrase that went viral today. You want to spin the wheel?
Sure. Is there a W?
Yes, there are two W's.
I'd like to solve the puzzle.
Okay, go ahead.
I now believe global warming alarmists are unpatriotic racists, knowingly misleading for their own ends. Good night.
You're right, Pat!
I'm more than right. I'm far right.
You've won the game. What will you do with your winnings?
Oh, use it to spread my own patented brand of all-American ignorance and misinformation to the people who get their climate change information from a blow-dried game show host.
Thanks for playing...
Wheel of Denial!
You're listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Good morning, everyone. I am Professor Michaela Williams. I will be your proctor for this examination, the 2014 SAT. You will have 4 hours to answer all the questions. You may begin the essay portion, for which you will have 25 minutes when I give the signal. You may begin now.
Hello there. You are the only person in this room reading these words. Welcome,
Brandon Merriweather,
to the Legacy SAT. Do not worry. You're going to be fine. The college of your choice,
Princeton University,
has already accepted you. Do not exhibit extreme emotion. Do not high-five the student next to you. Do not clench both fists and hiss yes under your breath. Keeping your cool while receiving massively privileged treatment is the main life lesson you must learn from taking this test. As you know,
Brandon,
the Supreme Court has ruled that race should not be a factor in college admissions. But we know, don't we, that being white and well off with a parent who attended
Princeton University
should always be a factor. Because in a stable society, hereditary privilege ensures continuity. Don't worry if you find that last sentence hard to grasp. It will not affect your score. As you can see from your answer sheet, an essay on the given assignment has been completed for you. You don't need to read it, but trust us,
You express yourself very clearly and your thoughts are well organized, but not so brilliantly as to attract unwanted attention.
What about the other sections, you ask? Well, many of the misguided folks who criticize the legacy system say a legacy has an advantage over others of about 160 points in his or her final score. But we thought, what the hey? Why waste your valuable time? Why not just answer all the questions in all the sections correctly, except for 160 points worth? And no,
Mr. Merriweather,
you do not have to figure out what 1,600 minus 160 is. FYI, it's 1,440. Good score, but not perfect. That's right, so as not to attract unwanted attention. So, all you have to do for the next 4 hours is look busy and fairly intelligent. Excellent training for all those tedious board meetings and HR gender bias hearings you're going to have to be sitting through. That is, after you graduate cum laude from
Princeton University.
Oh, and by the way,
Brandon,
we take care of that too.
Headquarters of the Los Angeles Police Department.
Chief, I just got off the phone with dispatch. They found a body at Alvarado and Sunset. Strangled again.
Damn it. All right, people, listen up. Looks like we got a serial killer on our hands. I'm deploying every man we've got. Until we learn more about this character, we're calling him the Hollywood Strangler.
Chief, not to be nitpicky.
What is it, Davis?
Well, Alvarado and Sunset isn't really Hollywood.
What do you mean? It's right there, Hollywood.
Nah, it's too far east. It's more like Echo Park. And the murder before that was at Crenshaw and Pico, which is well into central L.A.
All right, until we learn more about this character, we're calling him the Hollywood Adjacent Strangler.
Hollywood Adjacent at Crenshaw and Pico? You're practically on Interstate 10.
Hey, don't undersell those neighborhoods, people. Alvarado and Sunset has great shopping, and you're within spitting distance of a Trader Joe's.
The nearest Trader Joe's is 3 miles away, Chief. How far can you spit? I mean, Echo Park is a perfectly good neighborhood. You just can't call it Hollywood. And you can't rent out a one-bedroom apartment for more than $1,500.
Look, it's got to be the Hollywood Strangler, or there's just no point chasing him. Trust me, I worked in New York City chasing the Park Slope rapist after a victim turned up on 3rd Avenue.
Actually, 3rd Avenue isn't really Park Slope.
I know, but nobody gives a crap about the Gowanus rapist. Just like nobody pays attention to an Echo Park strangler or a Mid-Wilshire mauler or a Tarzana jewel thief. I don't care if the next victim turns up in Reno. He's the Hollywood Strangler, you understand?
All right, Chief. He's up. Okay, where do we start the investigation?
We start by asking ourselves, why is this strangler so obsessed with Hollywood? Please welcome the Palindrome Theater Players, Otis, Iris, Iris number 2, Roy, Adam, Dave, Ned, and Lou.
Ava, can I stab bats in a cave?
Sir, I'm Iris.
Sir, I demand. I am a maid named Iris.
Too hot to hoot.
Sit on a potato pan, Otis.
10 animals I slam in a net.
Eek!
Was it a rat I saw?
Step on no pets.
Too bad. I hit a boot.
Top step, Sarah's pet spot.
Top steps, pup's pet spot.
You can cage a swallow, can't you? But you can't swallow a cage, can you?
Draw, oh coward.
Roy,
am I Mayor?
Madam, I'm Adam.
Sir, I'm Iris.
Noel saw I was Leon.
Houston saw I was not Sue.
Lay a walla baby ball away, Al.
Madam, I'm Adam.
Draw, oh coward.
Lou, Otto has a hot towel.
Ned, go gag Ogden.
Let's have sex!
This has been Palindrome Theater. Except that last line.
Rebecca has been in the wrong L.A. You know, Los Angeles. And hopefully that hasn't changed her too much.
So you figured everything out about fashion?
Well, I just...
We interrupt our regularly scheduled programming for a Channel 3 special report.
The following rebuttal is presented by station KBAT in Bat City, Oklahoma, in response to local complaints about the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, by Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Howdy, and welcome to our rebuttal to Cosmos, a space-time thing. We call our version Cosmos 2, but so's we don't get sued, we spell Cosmos with a C.
Cosmos has a C.
Thanks to me it does. Don't mind him. I'm your host, Neil deGrasse Bryson. They call me deGrasse on account of a boil I had on my neck. That's gone now, but the name stuck.
That boil ain't gone. Take off that turtleneck, Neil.
Shut up, Luther. That's what makes me a scientist, along with the corduroy jacket and the elbow patches.
Elbow patches? That's duct tape.
Best patch there is. This here's my cousin Luther. I told him he could be my sidekick on Cosmos with a C.
The colored fella on the real show ain't got no sidekick. This is not a proper parody.
You want parody? Buy yourself a parrot, smartass. Luther brings up a good point. The show with the black scientist is full of mistakes, starting with black scientist. Men of science have always been white, like Sir Isaac Hayes.
You moron, he's black. And the name is Sir Isaac Newton.
Fine, Isaac Newton was black, but he's the only one. To watch that colored Cosmos guy, you'd think everybody that ever discovered anything was black, or an Arab, or a woman. What has a woman ever found?
Your pornography.
I left it in the bathroom, but I'll give her that. Here on Cosmos with a C, we want to salute real scientists. Like my other cousin, Shib. He determined the age of the universe by counting bathtub rings.
So how old is the universe?
9.
Idiot. We're older than 9.
Not according to science. Or my other cousin, Buford. He discovered a new method of cooking meth. Without his innovations, we never would have had that trailer explosion last summer.
And Buford would still have his hand.
Our point is this. Properly used, science can help us to dispel ignorance and superstition.
And Lord knows you couldn't correctly dispel either one of them.
Shut up, Luther. Science can show us we have more in common than we think. It can bring us together as one people. So screw science. That's our message.
We now return you to Duck Dynasty. Already in progress.
Progress.
Yeah, that's funny stuff.
Nobody told me you had a dog.
Look.
Why didn't...
You want to carry this, Jolly?
Oh, what is it? Oh, Rebecca, it's got dog poo in it.
Aww. Dad, where does our family come from?
Oh, honey, I don't know. My grandfather came from Germany or Thailand or someplace.
Dad, why did you divorce Mom?
Well, I hadn't seen her in a while, so...
Dad, why didn't you come to my ballet recitals?
I don't know. Booze, laundry, something.
Dad, why did Jennifer Aniston and Justin Theroux break up?
Oh, she really wants a family, and she desperately wants that baby, but he just can't seem to commit.
But they're still on again, off again. I mean, is she, like, just enabling him?
Honey, there comes a time in everyone's life when they have to judge whether Jennifer Aniston is living her life correctly.
and whether she's getting fat.
Take the time for the people who matter most in your life, celebrities. This message is brought to you by the dedicated men and women of the paparazzi, without whom we would never know what Emma Stone looks like without makeup.
You're listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour. Visit thefinaledition.com every day for more sizzling satire with teeth.
2014 is the centenary of the start of World War I, the first foreign war in which the United States fought not for oil or land or empire, but for a great principle, to put an end to all wars. Many Americans gave their lives for that great principle, but to none do we owe a greater debt than that American fighting man who made the ultimate sacrifice for us, yet when the dust of battle had settled, could not be identified. The unknown soldier, entombed at Arlington Cemetery, whose remains are guarded to this day in grateful tribute, and whose name is known but to God. See him now, almost a century ago, trudging up a dusty road of northern France, universal symbol of selfless valor, an ordinary man who gave his life so that countless others could live in freedom, who sought no reward, not even a headstone where his name and courage could be memorialized forever. No, not even that. Just the deep satisfaction of doing his duty for his beloved homeland, his America. As he comes near us, we see the blood drenching through the rough rags around his bowed head. Bowed, but not defeated. We see the muddy clay that cakes his boots, worn and battered by the endless slog of battle, the tattered uniform with its few remaining bronze eagle buttons, the dented helmet clipped to his belt, eternal evidence of the dirty work of war. He could be a farmhand from the South or Midwest, a machinist from a New England factory, a newsie from the bustling streets of Manhattan. Whatever work formed the strong, sure hands gripping his trusty Springfield, we will never know. But we do know what he has given for our nation. That gift than which, as the Bible says, there is no greater, to lay down his life for his fellow man. And we know this unknown man so well. We know that sturdy body and broad shoulders, those strong limbs and the undaunted spirit which animates them and on which our freedom depends. For he is our universal soldier, our sailor, our marine, our brave American boy, whose ultimate sacrifice will be remembered forever when the fields are white with daisies. He reaches us. He raises that tired but resolute face with its fierce blue eyes and determined jaw. A little smile creases its rough stubble as he quietly murmurs,
"Fick dich, amerikanischer Arschloch!"
It's time for another talk with Tony. Hey, forget about it. Tony Hendra, our fearless leader, has a good story to tell, and it's a story about creative inspiration and the depths of despair that the creatives can fall into. Those of you out there that consider yourself funny or creative or aspiring to do something special may come away wondering if you have to like vodka and Valium in order to succeed. And also how you wish that your down periods could have such beautiful settings. Nonetheless, it's a great story, and it's from The Moth, which I'm sure you're familiar with. If not, look it up. And now enjoy How Rock and Roll Saved My Life.
It's 1982. I am sitting in a sumptuous beach house in Malibu watching a magnificent Pacific sunset. And this is shaping up as the worst day of my life. I was in Los Angeles for two reasons. First, to promote my latest satirical publication, and secondly, to appear in a low-budget movie, which was the directorial debut of an old friend of mine. I wasn't terribly keen about this, never having been in a movie, and he had some deranged notion about shooting it like a documentary. The satirical publication was much more my speed. It was a time, as you probably remember, when there was a man in the White House who was talking quite blithely and frequently about a winnable nuclear war against the godless Soviets. And some of us in New York had decided this was a satirical opportunity, and we'd put together this parody pamphlet of the kind that would inform people of what they could do in the event of nuclear Armageddon. And it was put out by an agency called the Futile Preparedness Agency. And it gave you little tips about what you could do in the event of a direct hit by a, 100 megaton bomb on your home. It was called Meet Mr. Bomb. And Mr. Bomb was a very cheery, helpful 1950s hydrogen bomb with a wide smile and good teeth and a firm handshake. Now, Meet Mr. Bomb was quite funny, and Newsweek had said they were going to put it on their cover. So I had, at my own expense, 200,000 copies of this printed up. And I had just heard minutes earlier from my publisher that the largest distributor in the Southwest had read Mr. Bomb, and he had not enjoyed it. He was a Razorback Reaganite, and he had shredded every one of the 100,000 copies I'd shipped to him, refused to pay for them, and since I had no money left to sue him, I was effectively bankrupt. Now, the house I was staying in was, to some degree, a house of gloom. It belonged to a member of the band. Do you remember that legendary 60s group? I had once believed that the band was the greatest rock and roll group in history, if not the universe. And, of course, they had broken up a few years earlier for the usual egotistical, unnecessary reasons, leaving me bitterly disappointed. And the mood that I was in at that point, this breaking up seemed to me to be symptomatic of the age. Things were breaking up, falling apart. They were coming to an end. Peggy Noonan famously called those years morning in America. To me, they were more like late evening in America. And worse things than that were happening. I mean, a year before that, a deranged fan had shot John Lennon in the street. Not many months before this, a death much closer to home had happened, which was that of John Belushi. And I had given John Belushi his first job, actually, his first starring role in a show I produced for the National Lampoon called Lemmings. And Lemmings was a full-scale parody of Woodstock, at which all the great rock idols got theirs. And John was the sort of satanic MC of all this and was absolutely brilliant. And Lemmings became a big off-Broadway hit. And John was launched on his stellar career and his equally magnificent drug habit, which had just killed him. My first marriage was in ruins, and I knew that basically it was my fault. And it seemed to me somehow appropriate that I was in California. Because California is the end. I mean, it's the end of America. You can't go any further, right? It's after that, it's 5,000 miles of oceanic night, and then you get to China, and it all starts over again. And it was also appropriate that somehow this magnificent sunset was sliding gradually underneath the horizon into Stygian darkness. And for the first time in my life, I just wondered what the hell was the point in going on. Now, whoever owned this house, Robbie Robertson or Richard Manuel, whoever it was kind enough to have left a quart of vodka in it. And I also had with me my very first prescription for Valium. I'd always hated downers, and I'd never taken them, but I'd been sleeping badly, and my doctor said this was the answer. So these two things taken together seemed to me to present a perfect opportunity. So I laid out 10 Valium. I figured that's how many it would take. I took a big, big slug of vodka and took my first Valium ever, and then took another slug of vodka. Nothing much seemed to happen. So I took two more Valium and a really big hit of vodka this time. Still nothing. Clearly this wasn't going to work. I would have to take the remaining 7 Valium and get it over with. And so I took a really big hit of vodka to prepare myself for this step, and I picked up the Valium and I looked at them in my hand for a long time, and I fell asleep. And about 14 hours later, I woke, and I was still just as suicidal, but now I had a massive hangover, too. And I remember through the fog that I was supposed to be on a movie set, to be precise, about 4 hours earlier. And it was the last thing in the world I wanted to do, was be in a movie set, and especially a movie about rock and roll, which at this point I hated. And it didn't have a script, this movie. It had to be totally improvised, and I'd never improvised in my life either. But I was a professional, so I jumped in my car and sped across the Malibu Hills and to the location, and they rushed me into hair and wardrobe and so forth and so on, and rushed me to the set, and there were the three stars of the movie, looking absolutely hilarious in their fright wigs. And the set was actually a limo, and I was placed in the limo with them, and somebody yelled, "Action," and we were underway. And they were brilliant. None of them was British, but they all had perfect British accents. And they were being incredibly funny in character, intimidatingly funny. And I knew that very soon, one of them would turn to me and say something, and I would have to answer. Now, I'd done a little homework. I'd read up on improvisation, and I'd talked to all my friends who'd been in improv groups, and the consensus seemed to be that there was one basic rule you had to follow. Listen. You can't bring anything preconceived to improvisation. You must just listen, not just to what people are saying, the other people are saying, but to what their faces are saying, what their bodies and their movements are saying. And if you do that, just simply answer what you hear. It will work. And now the moment came. The character called David was turning to me, and he was saying something to me. And I could see in his face that his character thought my character was pretty sleazy. That this character, whose name was Ian, lied a lot. And out of my mouth came this voice that wasn't really mine. It was sort of evasive and sort of slimily ingratiating. And it had that kind of nasal whine, you know, that was beginning to creep into everyday English. And it worked. It was amazing. I mean, the scene was enabled to continue being funny. I mean, I wasn't funny, but I helped them be funny. And my friend, the director, was very happy with the scene, so we did another take of it, and he was even happy with that. And then we did another scene and another scene, and pretty soon the day was over, and I had completely forgotten all thoughts of offing myself. But more importantly, something quite wonderful was happening, which was these stars and the extended cast, and myself too, we were all in some way on the same emotional page. We had all sort of arrived at this deep disillusion and disappointment with this wonderful music that when we were younger we had such high hopes for, that we actually thought some of us would change things, would bring peace and rationality into life, would end racism and war, you remember? And it had betrayed us, and it had been betrayed for us, and it had been a source of failures and disappointments and vulgarity and stupidity and absurdity and pretension and so on. And this whole cast was just coming into that and devising and finding all these wonderful ways in which venality and cynicism and so forth had poisoned this whole area of the art world. And it wasn't the big sort of comedic set pieces that I loved. It was the little tiny ones where we would find out new dimensions of this. I'll just give you a quick example. This is actually the favorite scene, at least one of the favorite scenes that I'm in. It's sort of in the middle somewhere. It's about Nigel, who's the lead guitarist, being backstage before a concert. And a large amount of food has been delivered to Nigel. And he's not at all happy with it. And specifically, there's some very small slices of bread which have been delivered with this. And Nigel just doesn't understand. I don't see how the bits of meat, how they're too small. The bread's too small for the meat. Look, you see, it won't work. I want big meat. I want big bread, okay? And it is Ian's job, my character's job, to talk this moron down, you know. So that he can go out on stage and play the loudest music in the world to brain-dead teenagers, and they keep buying tickets. That's his job. And Ian does it in this kind of mothering, like, he's like a kind aunt, you know? And yet at the same time, it's incredibly cynical, incredibly manipulative, and so on. So anyway, that sort of body of work came together throughout this. It was just a wonderful, wonderful shoot. And I would actually venture to say that... that Spinal Tap actually isn't a mockumentary. Because of this wonderful cinematographer we had, Peter Smokler, it was actually a documentary record of a really fascinating collective comedic experiment that took place at a certain point in time and couldn't have been at any other point in time. And that was a success. And I think that's why it sort of works. That's where it gets its edge and authenticity. And I have one little epitaph to this. I haven't the foggiest idea what it means, but I'm going to throw it in anyway. This was about 5 years later, and Spinal Tap was sort of had been out for about 3 years and was sort of on its way to becoming the minor classic that it became. And I got into a cab in New York, and my driver was a quintessential acid casualty. I mean, he had one of those beribboned kind of ponytails down to his ass crack, you know. And and he peered in the rearview mirror and he said, "Hey, man, weren't you in Spinal Tap?" And I said, yeah, I played the manager, yeah, he said. And he said, "Oh, man, I really dig their music. It's so far out." He said, "You know, man, I was into Tap before they made that movie."
I'm former CNN correspondent Ashley Maestrap, and this is my new show, Eye on Crime. On tonight's show, we're focusing on Peeping Toms, and with me this evening is one Mr. Reginald Schumer.
Schumacher.
My apologies, Mr. Shoemaker.
Schumacher.
Reggie, when I first heard about your story, I was just enraged. I mean, I thought my head was going to explode.
It was somewhat of a frustrating experience, but I'm doing the
Now,
best.
Reggie, you were a victim of a Peeping Tom. Please tell our listeners your story.
Well, I guess I should clarify. I was actually, in fact, the accused Peeping Tom.
People like you make me sick.
Okay. But what happened was, while volunteering with a local animal rescue group, I followed a stray dog into a backyard when it got caught up in some bushes. I was trying to help the poor little guy get untangled, but it turned out to be a holly bush, and I'm severely allergic to holly, so I started having a violent reaction.
I think you are truly one of the most amazing human beings I have ever met.
Oh, well, thank you. However, I wasn't aware there was a very elderly woman changing in front of her open bathroom window, which was located just above the bushes. She mistook me for a Peeping Tom and called the authorities. Blinded and with my face swollen from the reaction to the holly, I ran out into the front lawn, wherein the police had already arrived and immediately took me into custody.
You poor man. It just disgusts me when I hear these stories about local law enforcement taking advantage of their power and harassing innocent taxpayers like yourself. I mean, it just makes me want to vomit.
Well, by the time the police got me to the station, the allergic reaction had calmed down. I was able to show them my volunteer credentials and explain what really happened. They were very understanding and released me right away. One of the officers even gave me a ride home.
No, you were wrongly accused, emotionally assaulted. You're probably suffering from PTSD right now. This sort of thing really gets my ire up. Let's take some calls. Caller number one, go ahead. That is so insightful. Thank you for sharing. Caller number two. I hear you, girl. I hear you. Let's take one more call.
Everyone keeps raping me with their eyes.
See, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Well, this has been our show, and I'd like to thank you, Mr. Schumacher, for your bravery and honesty.
America needs more heroes like you. This has been Eye on Crime, because wherever there is crime, we'll be watching it with our eyes.
I'm Herbert Schreiber, and this is the all-Broadway talk show, Who Needs Tickets? Who Needs Tickets? With me are Woody Allen, Julie Taymor, Ian Faith, and David Merrick. The Tonys are coming up in a month. Woody Allen, your new musical, Bullets Over Broadway, has received 6 nominations.
Might I interject one concept at this juncture?
Yes.
I can't go to award shows. They make me nauseous. I should be home, quietly masturbating.
Ian Faith, you were the manager for Spinal Tap. I understand you're here to talk about an exciting new musical.
Yes, Tap of Ages.
It's a jukebox musical with Spinal Tap songs?
Well, not a jukebox musical per se. I suppose it's more of an iPod musical. Actually, what you have to do is get an account on Spotify and listen to it there.
So it's the world's first music streaming musical.
It's a different kind of musical. I mean, there aren't any songs in it.
How can there be no songs in a musical?
The band couldn't get the rights.
Spinal Tap couldn't get the rights to their own songs? Why not?
Well, for one thing, they didn't ask.
So what does the audience see for 2 hours?
I don't advise trying to see anything. You see, all the seats have an obstructed view. You're better off just buying the soundtrack and then next year buying the deluxe remastered version.
That doesn't sound like a theatrical experience.
No, it's more of a transactional experience, I suppose.
Could I say something about Indonesian theater vis-a-vis my artistic temperament?
Julie Taymor.
My latest Broadway boondoggle combines life-size animal puppets with disfiguring spinal injuries. It's called Spider King 2, Turn Off the New York State Labor Violations.
Is that the one that requires the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to print more money to pay for it?
Contempt for your audience doesn't come cheap. Plus, Bono and Edge wrote the music, and we have to keep buying Edge those stupid wool caps.
Julie, would you be averse to Spinal Tap stealing some of their songs?
You can steal all of them. The songs they write for Broadway suck, man. They only write good stuff for movies about Nelson Mandela.
If I could interject the concept, the difference between me and Bono is he still hasn't found what he's looking for. I've found what I'm looking for, but I creep everybody out.
David Merrick, your Tony Award-winning productions include 42nd Street, Look Back in Anger, Gypsy, Cactus Flower, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and many, many others. You are a legendary producer.
Well, I'm also a dead producer. I died in 2000 at the age of 88.
Is this another trademark Merrick publicity stunt?
Oh, kind of. I'm the first producer to receive a full-scale Broadway revival.
Do you think you'll scare theatergoers?
No. I may be a reanimated corpse, but I'm not as scary as all those Times Square Elmos.
That's our show. Join me next time when my guests will be Adele Nazim, the Michael Jackson hologram, and the deaf language interpreter for Los Monologos de la Vagina.
Steve?
Yes?
Come in. Have a seat.
Thank you, Doctor.
Well, Steve, why don't you tell me why you're here?
Doctor, I'm just very angry and frustrated and depressed.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
I'm not breaking through on Twitter.
I see.
I'm just extremely disappointed by the whole experience.
Well, a lot of people do get their hopes up about it, only to find things don't quite pan out the way they expected. Isn't it supposed to be fun?
Fun? I don't think so.
Well, a number of my other patients seem to enjoy it.
So why did they come to see you?
Well, people have other problems besides not breaking through on Twitter.
I guess.
Keep in mind, it wasn't that long ago people were worried they weren't breaking through on MySpace.
I'm not following you.
Anyway, so you feel that Twitter has not given you the recognition that you deserve. Have you thought about quitting it?
No, that's not even an option. I mean, if all those other people don't quit, how can I quit?
You know, Steve, people drop out of Twitter all the time.
Maybe they do, but there's so many people on it, you don't even notice it.
Are you afraid that people will notice you've quit or that they won't notice you've quit?
Either one would be bad, wouldn't it?
Well, that's something only you can decide. How long have you been on it?
About 2 years.
And how many followers do you have?
As of this morning, 237.
Okay. That's not great.
I know, doctor. That's why I'm here.
How often do you tweet?
I try to do it every day, but sometimes a week goes by, 2 weeks.
Well, it's important to be consistent.
I know. But I get discouraged when I'm not retweeted. It just really ticks me off. It makes me wonder, why do I even bother?
Do you work hard on your tweets?
Yes, I spend a lot of time on them. Not like most of these people write crap about Game of Thrones. My tweets matter to me. I mean, it's the internet. This may be the closest I ever get to being published.
Do you want to get published?
Of course.
Are you writing a book?
Well, I have some ideas.
Like what?
Maybe a book of my tweets?
Steve, if you think you're angry and frustrated now...
I'm sorry I mentioned it. But do you think people on Twitter are avoiding me deliberately?
I seriously doubt it. 99.9% of them don't even know you're alive.
Those bastards! That's exactly how it feels. It's like I'm dumping buckets of water into the ocean. What are you writing?
Do you follow people when they follow you?
Yes, usually.
How many people are you following?
I don't know, probably around 73. No. 79.
Obviously, you're not following people when they follow you.
Not always. I mean, what if they're not funny?
Most people aren't that funny, Steve, but that's the chance you'll have to take. From now on, I want you to follow everyone who follows you without exception.
Okay, but if just once they mention anything about their cats, that's it.
I wouldn't be too fussy. It is just the internet.
Oh, I almost forgot. I brought along some of my tweets for you to read. Thought maybe you could give me some feedback.
Well, we're almost out of time, but... Okay. Are these them?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I see. Okay.
Which one was that?
Our family reunion was a big disappointment. My grandmother just died, so we didn't have anyone to play the drums.
Yeah, I like that one.
Hmm.
What is it? Doctor?
Well, thank you for showing me these.
They're good, right?
Yes, many of them are humorous observations and jokes.
Exactly. So I'm not crazy, right? I mean, shouldn't I be farther along considering my talent?
Well, if things really worked that way, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
I just want to be relevant.
Of course, Steve, we all do, but that may no longer be possible.
I'm still on Facebook, but that feels like it's over.
Yeah, Facebook's probably over.
Maybe Twitter's over, too.
Well, that's inevitable, but it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. You do only have 237 followers.
Yes. Why am I letting them down? I have to work harder. Do you think I'm just a self-centered putz?
Let's talk about that next week. Don't forget to pay Kelly on the way out.
Thank you, Doctor. Sometimes I feel like the ground is sinking under my feet.
I know. Have you tried Instagram?
The Final Edition Radio Hour is performed at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hindra, Jeff Hendrick, Kevin Janis, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, Rachel Rauch, Steve Rosenfield, Ann Tuchel, and Darby Worley. The Final Edition Radio Hour is written, at one time or another, by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hindra, Jeff Hendrick, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, and Steve Rosenfield. The Final Edition Radio Hour is produced by Tony Hindra and Jeff Chrysler, West Coast producer Barry Lank. The Final Edition Radio Hour is edited and audio produced by Greg Russ and Andrew Hammond. The Final Edition Radio Hour is the property of the Final Edition LLC, copyright 2014.